From the studios of Kootenai Co-op Radio, this is Deconstructing Dinner.
Welcome to Deconstructing Dinner, produced in Nelson, British Columbia, at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman. Produce to the People, the title of today's show and the title of a panel discussion hosted in March of this year in San Francisco. Similar to a recent panel discussion aired here on the show titled Climate Friendly Eating, this one was too hosted by the Center for Urban Education about Sustainable Agriculture, or CUESA, a San Francisco-based nonprofit who, since 1994, has been educating urban consumers about sustainable agriculture and creating links between urban dwellers and local farmers. CUESA also manages the Ferry Plaza Market and has done so since 1999. The Produce to the People panel examined a few inspiring models for getting fresh local food to residents in the Bay Area and featured Grayson James of Petaluma Bounty, Melanie Chang of Farms Reach, and Christine Cherbunwang of the Oakland Farms to Schools Network and Oakland Fresh School Produce Markets. Moderating the panel was Michael DeMock of Roots of Change. And at the end of the broadcast today, a new episode from Bucky Bacaw and his Backyard Chicken Broadcast. This week, Bucky discusses the pros and cons of eating raw eggs and provides suggestions on the safest source of those eggs to reduce the exposure risk to salmonella. Deconstructing Dinner has long been exploring the many ways in which farmers, businesses, organizations, and communities are accessing food using new and innovative models. On today's broadcast, we hear more of those examples shared as part of the March 2010 panel, Produce to the People, hosted by the San Francisco-based organization, CUESA. Moderating the panel was Michael DeMock, the president of Roots of Change, a collaboration of community, nonprofit, philanthropic, government, and business organizations, all seeking to accelerate the transition to more sustainable food systems in California. Of the three panelists heard first in this next clip is Christine Cherbunwang, the coordinator for the Oakland Farms to School Network and the Oakland Fresh School Produce Markets, a program of the Oakland Unified School District Nutrition Services and the East Bay Asian Youth Center. The markets are set up to sell fresh, mostly locally grown and pesticide-free fruits, vegetables, eggs, nuts, honey, and other foods at public schools. The produce is purchased from local family farms and distributors and sold by parents and students during after-school hours every week at each school site. The markets, which operate at 12 schools, are open to parents, students, staff, and community residents, and their goal is to open 25 markets by 2012. Also on the panel, Grayson James, the executive director of Petaluma Bounty, a nonprofit organization based in Petaluma, California, and formed in 2006. The organization works to create a sustainable Petaluma food system with healthy, fresh food for everyone by helping residents to grow their own healthy food, by redistributing surplus food, and also providing affordable fresh food to low-income families and seniors. And also on the panel, Melanie Chang, the founder of Farms Reach, an online farm food marketplace focusing on the San Francisco Bay Area that connects farmers to business buyers. Their mission is to help businesses source fresher and healthier foods and put better food on more plates while supporting healthy farms. Here's Michael DeMock.
And I think what we'd like to do first is just have you each take about 3 minutes and not really describe the projects, because we're going to get into that, but describe who you are, what it is that you do on a daily basis that describes who you are. In essence, what is it that you do? And Christine, do you want to go first?
So I coordinate the Oakland Farms to Schools Network and the Oakland Fresh School Produce Markets. And that is a network of 12 school produce markets in Oakland public schools. I can get more into the details of how it works later, but we created it originally as a way to increase access to more healthy, affordable food in the neighborhood specifically through the school institution. We decided to focus on the school institution. You know, each school that we work at has 300 to 700 students and their families who go there and pick them up after school. And so very significant community institutions where children also eat one or two of their meals, a lot of them too, because at least 70% of the children at all the schools we work at qualify for free and reduced lunch and breakfast. But I'm getting too much into the project.
Well, what motivated you to get into it? Why did you get into this?
you know, in the present day and age and in this society, distribution is important because, you know, just going back to in human history, I mean, we don't live in a reality anymore where our intimate knowledge of the environment around us is how we get our food. You know, we're not wildcrafting and, you know, hunting our food, but things like agricultural subsidies and, you know, living wage, you know, determine our food system and what kind of access we have to food and how institutions of like food retail are set up in our communities. And to just kind of illustrate, I mean, two examples. One is actually that was one example that I thought of also is the Central Valley example, because there's actually also produce markets in the Central Valley. They run a similar project, and they were telling me something very similar, that, you know, that this is the breadbasket where they, you know, export tons of food to the whole world, and residents there have to drive, you know, at least 45 minutes to the nearest grocery store, and they're surrounded by food. And so that, you know, like that's what we live in. And then another example is that a farmer that I worked with, like he comes from Mexico, and you know, his parents and his grandparents were farmers, and he went through the ALBA program to learn to you know, kind of learn the economics of being a farmer in this country. It's I'm just, you know, kind of empathizing with the farmer side of things. Like, it's hard for him to, you know, even with us working with him, it's hard for us to get a price that is something that our community is willing to pay for, but at the same time is something that supports him. And it's just kind of ironic that he can't make a living supporting, you know, folks, you know, who probably, you know, a lot of the folks in our community maybe grew up in the same town that he did. But, you know, I think a lot of his livelihood probably depends on higher end markets like the Berkeley Farmers Market.
Grayson, same question. Essence of what you do and why you got into it.
So I'm going to start by giving a little background about how Petaluma Bounty came to be, which may or may not shed light on how I came to be involved with it. I was contacted as a consultant about 5 years ago by a local foundation in Petaluma, and the foundation was interested in how to address the issue of hunger in Petaluma. Most of you probably know Petaluma is a small burg, the gateway to the wine country, about 50 minutes north of here. And it's very picturesque, charming Victorian town. And, you know, when you drive through on your way to other places, you wouldn't think that there is much hunger or food insecurity. And as I got into, I was interested in the project, and I began talking to all the folks in the emergency network, food network, which was really where the focus of this foundation was. What can we do to bolster the emergency food network to address hunger and food insecurity? And as I began talking to these people and talking to educators and healthcare folks, it started to become clear to me that, first of all, the emergency food system is pretty strong. It's in pretty good shape, in Petaluma at least. And there is a lot of food moving to a lot of people. The other thing that I noticed was that probably we could multiply that quantity of food and people by 10 or 20, and fundamentally, things wouldn't be any different. We could put a lot of money into the system. We could get a lot more food purchased and moving. And we would be where we are, except worse, in 5 or 10 years, which led me to start to look at what other communities are doing that are maybe looking upstream of the food pantry lines. And that led to what's often referred to as a community food security approach. So then the next 9 to 12 months were spent really mapping out how that might this work for Petaluma. And one of the things in my background was that I was very involved in working with teams and folks, helping them to try and figure out how to collaborate better. And I saw all of these disconnects in the emergency food system where all these groups were working, doing great things, but they weren't talking to each other. And the educators and the healthcare providers weren't involved in the process. So I saw this really great opportunity to start to create conversations and linkages. And that led ultimately to Petaluma Bounty. And I'd say that my abiding concern is how to really make some kind of a difference at a level where we don't have to keep thinking that we should be building more emergency rooms to solve our healthcare crisis any more than we should be building more food pantries to solve our food crisis. So that's fundamentally where I'm coming from.
Good. Melanie.
So I first started Ohm Organics because I was really passionate about organic agriculture in particular. And that was before I really understood the problems in the industry on a bigger scale. And trying to work with these organic farmers, it was very clear that one of their major problems was just getting their stuff to market. And it applied not only to organic farmers, but all the farmers that I was working with at the farmers market. And that really opened my eyes to the bigger economic problems in the food system and distribution. And it also led to Farms Reach, which is focused on connecting farmers with wholesale buyers. Because I went to a conference way back when, and that was when I heard this surprising statistic that less than 1% of food sales in America is going through farmers markets and CSAs. So even if it quadruples, it's still a tiny fraction of the volume of food in the country. So with Farms Reach, I was thinking, idealistically, you know, if we could create a marketplace for the wholesale channel, that's a better chance for a big win. And so it's been a journey. Farms Reach was launched in 2007, and initially the focus was on farm co-ops, because at that time, these farmers market consolidation programs or rural area aggregation across multiple farms, that was kind of the hot new model that everyone was thinking was the way of the future. But it turns out that wasn't necessarily true, and those models are still trying to figure out how to make a viable business out of it. So in 2008 is when we really scaled back the feature set to really serve farmers directly to wholesale buyers instead of the aggregation model through these nonprofits. And so 2008 and 2009 is when we were really focused on the features for the farms and making sure a farm can broadcast their availability to their customers directly. And this year is really when we're evolving again with the industry as one of the new models that is working across the country in various regions is the concept of clusters of businesses collaborating across the vertical. And these models, which I'll describe in a second, they are profitable. And so the fact that there's at least six groups who have pretty established businesses following this model is really where we're trying to take Farms Reach to, you know, be the tool that can facilitate this sort of program in other regions. And so just really briefly talking about what are clusters of business collaborating across the vertical, it's basically a mishmash of nonprofits, for-profits, and maybe government agencies who help sign up specific farms, specific buyers, specific processors and packers and distributors. And usually there's one nonprofit organization or one or two who coordinate the whole shebang. So instead of assuming markets are going to organically grow, it's just not happening. And so what is working in these collaborations, it's a lot of hand-holding and aligning manually supply and demand by getting the buyers and farmers engaged in one specific program, pre-planning, you know, the market for the season, and then helping facilitate the logistics. And sadly, I think the industry is in such a dire state where it really needs that much handholding to align supply and demand and actually have a profitable regional food system. And so that is really, in my opinion, one of the more promising models, the fact that it can survive and sustain itself.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, where we're featuring a panel discussion hosted in March of this year in San Francisco. In this next segment, moderator Michael DeMock asks panelists why they believe local regional food systems are so important.
I think we should get at the underlying assumption around all this, because if you're in a conversation like I was last week with these traditional market makers, distributors, or produce houses, that is packer shippers in, let's say, Ventura County, who are growing lettuce and crop vegetable crops, you know, they might look at the system and say, well, the system works. Why are we doing something different? So I want to get at the question of what is the focus on regional and local about? Where is the demand emerging from that you're responding to? Why is Grayson looking at local production? Christine, why are you focused? And why did you create a technology tool? What is it about local and regional? So Melanie, why don't you take a stab at that first?
Okay. Well, basically the overall premise is that regional food systems are the only sustainable food system. And there are some obvious reasons. One, it's the freshest quality food because it's right from your backyard. It doesn't need to travel a long time or long distance. It's environmentally better in that less fossil fuels are needed to transport and cool these perishable things around the world. And lastly, it supports local economies, which not only helps get more money back into the farmers' pockets so they can make a living, but it keeps money circulating in a community just for baseline economic vitality. And other byproducts of it is safety, just knowing where it's from and having source identification because it's from your own region. There are very few, if any, Salmonella, E. coli type outbreaks in regional food systems. And lastly, the ecological and aesthetics of having a thriving, vibrant, rural agricultural landscape, you know, where farms are thinking about the land and water and biodiversity. It's an aesthetic and economically and ecologically smart thing.
Great. Grayson, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would just say all of the above, and that from the sustainability perspective that Julia spoke about, economic, ecological, and social, what we're looking for is elegant solutions. We're always, in any field, we're always looking for what are the things that we can do that can have the biggest impact, the simpler things that can actually, you know, ripple out and affect a lot of things. And I think a local and/regional approach actually does all of these things very well. I would also just say that I would temper it by saying that I don't think, from my perspective, we're not going for only local. I don't know any community in the United States that's in danger of having too much local or regional food, and we probably won't be for quite a while. But if we were encountering such a situation, I think at the other end of the spectrum, there are some problems with that too. So I think finding some kind of balance in terms of a resilient food system that can respond to shocks or disruptions. For instance, if Petaluma was 100% or 90% dependent on growing food within a very small radius, and a major earthquake happened, that's a bad example, drought, which we do experience, water shortages, certain kinds of pests, we would find ourselves in a really vulnerable place, kind of the other end of the spectrum from what we usually talk about in sort of the foodie world, which is that the large-scale, long-distance transport is always the enemy. I think, yeah, we should really move away from that as much as we can, but I think we have to find some balance.
So it's about proportion, yeah. Balance.
Yeah, I think, and it also really depends on the community. So Petaluma is very different than Tempe, Arizona. Mm-hmm. So, you know, looking at what the right balance is for each community is important.
Good. Christine, what do you have to add?
You know, what really hits home for families at our markets is just the freshness, like, first of all, and that I think that connection to the memory of growing food, which I think a lot of families have. And then I also wanted to just add to that also just for folks to consider when, you know, in the local food movement, because it has been a challenge for us too at our markets, because we do, you know, push local food. And at the same time, there's also demand for, you know, because we work in a largely immigrant community, there's also demand for the culturally familiar foods that, maybe grow outside of this climate or don't grow year-round in this climate, like tomatoes and tomatillos and hot peppers and stuff like that.
That's Christine Cherbenwank of the Oakland Farms to School Network. Christine sat on a panel with Melanie Chang of Farms Reach and Grayson James of Petaluma Bounty. Today's broadcast is archived on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca and the September 30th, 2010 episode. Moderating the Produce to the People panel was Michael DeMock, who in this next clip asks panelists how they believe communities can work to increase the supply of food produced locally. Distribution appears to be one of the key areas of concern and opportunity.
There's some real demand out there for regional local foods. And so the question is, how can we actually increase the supply? And what are the means that you're pursuing? And, you know, there's a lot of things that we'll hear about in detail now, the technologies, the business models, the creative reuse of or repurposing of existing facilities and infrastructure. So, Grayson, why don't you start?
Maybe a good place to start is when I think about distribution, because I tend to oversimplify things, I'll do it here. To oversimplify distribution, it's basically how we get food. So there are four ways that I think we get food. One is we grow it ourselves. Another is we can glean it from somebody else that's growing it. Another is we buy it. Another is that we receive it, as in food pantry. We accept it, donated food, which is, you know, the first two are similar and the second two are similar. So if we have that as the kind of the A definition of distribution, it makes sense of what a lot of our efforts are. And for Petaluma Bounty, what we're doing is we're working each of those in a different way. We have an educational urban farm in the center of Petaluma, which is where we have a professional farm manager to really maximize output, but we do it in a way that involves a lot of volunteers, students, folks of all ages learning about sustainable agriculture. And that has a CSA, which is a community shared agriculture, which is a fancy term for a weekly box of food that goes to people who pay usually in advance to participate in this program. Our program is we're fundamentally concerned about equity and about making sure that everybody in our food system has access to healthy food. We have we sell food at wholesale prices to folks that can't afford regular retail, and we sell at retail prices to folks that can. We do that in our Bounty Box. We also do that in our Bounty Mobile Market, which is essentially a donated pickup truck that drives around at locations in Petaluma selling farm food and food that we also purchase from other local organic farms. We have a network of community gardens. We've started 5 community gardens so far, including our most recent one at Petaluma City Hall, and which I think is just I think every city needs one. And, of course, we had a beautiful temporary garden out here during the summer in San Francisco. We have a Bounty Hunters program, which is a community food gleaning program. And the emphasis there is, so our mission is to create a sustainable Petaluma food system with healthy food for everyone. And how do you change a food system? Well, we think you need to change a food system by engaging everybody in the community. So we can't just focus on one sector of the population, just the low-income folks, for instance. So we're trying to find ways to engage people at all levels of the community, all income levels, and different cultures and backgrounds. And gleaning is one way of doing that, because we have a lot of gardeners in Petaluma, long agricultural heritage. So we glean food from backyards, front yards, and local orchards, and we distribute it to local food pantries and seniors and others. Our last program is on the growing side is Backyard Bounty, and that's essentially an edible landscaping service. We're trying to be entrepreneurial, so that as we're trying to create a more sustainable system, food system, we're also trying to become more sustainable ourselves, because I think that's important to be able to do. So that's a start for Petaluma Bounty.
Great. Let's see, Christine.
So like I mentioned earlier, the Oakland Fresh School Produce Markets are a network of currently 12 school produce markets at public elementary schools in Oakland. And this is an expansion of a project that we piloted at 2 elementary schools in Oakland a few years ago. And it just was very well received by the community, by parents, and by the school community as a way of, you know, providing very convenient way for parents when they come and pick up their kids from school to buy their groceries right there affordably. And, you know, when they come and pick up their kids after school, there's, you know, 3 long tables set up under a canopy and some scales, and parents are selling the produce, and there's, you know, like an average of 50 varieties of produce there on the table that they can buy at affordable prices, pretty low markup from what we purchase the produce from the farmers. And so we actually partnered with the school district. The reputation built enough for the Nutrition Services Department to be interested in partnering with us. And actually, they are hosting the central distribution for the network. And so that means they're the same trucks that are delivering produce to the cafeterias for the school lunch are also delivering the produce to the school markets. you know, the same truck drivers, and we're using their central warehouse where they receive pretty much everything, you know, from like furniture to textbooks or whatever that goes, you know, to the school district and out to different school sites. And we're receiving our food there at the warehouse and using their central cold storage as well. And so that's actually where the farmers come to deliver to us to the warehouse. And so we work with a mixture of local farmers as well as a distributor of veritable vegetable, which most of you probably know, a distributor of organic produce. And actually, like I mentioned, because of the demand that we've had from a lot of our Latino parents, which are the majority at many of the schools we work with, we've also actually just this week started to include conventionally grown produce, you know, things like tomatillos and pasilla peppers and things like that that are not local right now. So we have the partnership with the school district, and then in addition, we also have partnerships with individual school sites, and so we require commitment from each of the schools to appoint a school site liaison, which is an existing paid staff person of the school. You know, it could be a teacher or secretary or someone like that, who is just really into the project, committed to making sure it's successful, and supervising the market manager. And then that's another commitment, is that the school hires a part-time market manager to run the market, and ideally that it's a parent and that they're supervised by the school site liaison. And so that team recruits more parent volunteers from the school to run that market. And so the market is run by parents at the school, largely volunteer-based, and then the market manager is paid out of actually school funds. I think the main points to emphasize, I guess, in that model is, I guess, one, the, you know, that partnership with the school institution and using the infrastructure that the school district already has. And also, I think, you know, the way that we've been able to really tap into the community to run these markets, and it's really, you know, run by the community and is very responsive to what the community wants. You know, if we don't have what parents want out there, then it's not going to succeed as a market. And so it really does reflect, hopefully, you know, what the community wants.
It's a great program.
Melanie.
Thanks. Well, Grayson, you're accused of simplifying things. I'm sometimes accused of being too macro, so I thought I'd do that now, too. So the kind of the overall philosophy behind Farms Reach is just that there's three fundamental problems with the distribution system for food. One is the lack of infrastructure that Michael talked about, just not having those aggregation or distribution hubs in rural areas or urban areas anymore. The second is that there's really no marketplace for local sustainable foods for the wholesale market. For consumers, there's obviously farmers markets, but for the bigger wholesale channel, there's literally no resource or database to identify who all the growers are in your area and actually know what they have available for harvest or to purchase at that moment. And the third is, because there's no marketplace, there's really no historical data being collected about what is being produced and what is being bought. And so how do you optimize a system when there's no data even being collected? And so with Farms Reach, that's really what we've been trying to address. Oh, and just another byproduct of not having a marketplace and not having data is that farms really guess what to grow and hope that they can sell it. And then they guess what to charge. We've talked with a lot of distributors and buyers where we ask them how they feel about pricing or how do they set pricing, you know, for distributors when they're reselling. And they say so many farms call a distributor they trust and just ask, what is the going rate or what do you feel like paying? So it, you know, it doesn't follow any economic theory in any way. And so, again, you know, there already are problems getting fresh, healthy foods into the mainstream wholesale channels. So it's no surprise that there are problems getting healthy foods to underserved lower income populations as well. And so that's really why at Farms Reach are focused so much on just these three fundamental things of infrastructure, marketplace, and price. Because we feel that, you know, if we can solve those major problems, Achilles heels, then a lot of the other things will start to fall into place. And, you know, getting better wages to farms, just as a segue that illustrates how systemic the problem is. At EcoFarm Pre-Conference, there was a guy talking about labor issues and getting farms a fair wage. And they were saying how they would have big successes getting farms engaged on paying their farms, you know, market or minimum wage for that area. And I talked to him after and I said, how do you do that? You know, because farms, more than half the farms in the country don't even report a positive income. How do they just up the wage just because they want to? And he confessed that that's actually the biggest problem. They get them signed up with a program, but because they don't have the distribution and marketplace solution, market solutions, they aren't that successful yet in actually getting the farmers a fair wage. So if we can just first have a marketplace that even can start collecting information of what is being grown and try to align that with demand more, that's a huge thing. And then that having that sort of data, you can start following economic theory, and that was my major, of finding the right fair market value for things. And so just some examples, just in the question was, you know, what is working to address these problems? Just as far as infrastructure, Growers Collaborative, they just changed their business model to provide these aggregation centers. Previously, they were doing more of the farm co-op distribution, and I'm really happy about this new move, which I think is working in other regions. And I think ultimately we have to recreate these aggregation hubs in the rural areas so all these smaller, medium-sized farms can reach the mainstream. Also, in the Bay Area, specifically, Farms Reach is collaborating with four other organizations, Marin Organic, CAF, Great Valley, and Vault, to do one of those clusters of businesses, vertical collaborations, you know, where we're going to handhold big buyers with the farmers and really make it happen as far as getting the food from the buyer, from the farmer to the buyer. And that's going to be a partnership also with Growers Collaborative's Aggregation Point and their great conventional distributor partners who can help actually move the stuff. So I think what the most compelling models to me are ones where it is a collaboration of nonprofits and for-profits working together and not trying to create this whole new alternative distribution system, but rather leverage the conventional people who are ready to step up, which is happening here, which is awesome.
This is Deconstructing Dinner, a syndicated radio show and podcast produced in Nelson, British Columbia at Kootenai Co-op Radio, CJLY. I'm John Steinman, and if you like our weekly content and have not yet supported this not-for-profit radio show, you can donate to our work on our website at deconstructingdinner.ca. On today's broadcast, titled Produce to the People, we're featuring a panel discussion hosted in March 2010 by the Center for Urban Education about Sustainable Agriculture, CUESA, based in San Francisco. Sitting on the panel was Grayson James of Petaluma Bounty, Melanie Chang of Farms Reach, and Christine Cherbenmoeng of the Oakland Farms to School Network. With a couple more clips to share from that inspiring panel discussion, you can also expect later on the show today a new episode from regular contributor Bucky Bacaw and his Backyard Chicken broadcast. But first, moderator Michael DeMock, who introduces the topic of gleaning, which for Grayson James of Petaluma Bounty is a focus of his organization's work.
So Grayson, I'd like you to talk a little bit more about gleaning. We live in Sonoma County, and there's a lot of stuff going on with gleaning in Sonoma County, and I know it's happening in other places. So, you know, just talk a little bit more about what you see the full capacity of gleaning is and the potential for it and what you're doing specifically, like the volume you're doing and that.
Okay. Gleaning's been around for several thousand years, probably. It's kind of come back into its own recently as part of the local food movement, I think, and often associated with religious groups, faith-based groups are often doing it, and more just regular nonprofits, non-faith-related groups are involved.
Does everybody know what gleaning is, first of all? Does everybody know? Does anybody here not need an explanation?
Okay, so gleaning is when you, there are different models of it, but it's essentially helping to harvest somebody else's land and either using that food for yourself or to donate to somebody else. In the old days, before all of us, gleaning was a part of the culture where farmers were admonished to always make a part of their fields available to passersby and indigent folks so they could help themselves to, you know, certain part of the crops. So the way we're practicing at one end of the spectrum, as I said, is in backyards and local orchards. And there's here in San Francisco a great group called Food Runners, which is gleaning from commercial institutions and caterers and restaurants. So that's a whole different source of gleaning. We're not doing that, but we're watching them closely. And there are folks, Marin Organics, they have an effort that gleans, sort of systematically gleans fields, farm fields in Marin, and the food goes to school kitchens in Marin. So that's a great relationship there. One of the questions that people often ask about gleaning is what happens if somebody gets sick or the food is bad? And in the mid-90s, under Clinton's watch, the Good Samaritan Act was passed, which basically provides liability protection for anybody who donates food in good faith. And what we do from a practical perspective is we just make sure that all the people who bring food to our collection sites and our volunteer drivers, it's all volunteer driven, that if you wouldn't need it, then you don't pass it along. And we started this program. It was from the background that I mentioned earlier. I personally was least interested in this program because it was the most directly in line with the emergency food system, and I was much more interested in getting people growing food and other forms of distribution. So we put virtually no money towards this, and we were projected by this point in time, about 3.5 years out, that we would be moving, maybe 800, 1,000 pounds of food a month in the community. And we're pushing 200,000 pounds in the last 2.5 years. And it just turns out that people really hate to see their food go to waste. How many of you can relate, you growers? So, when you have an opportunity to see that food that you're growing go somewhere else than rotting on the ground, you're going to do it. So there's that. And then it also ties into the really well-established hunger relief mentality that is really strong in this country and certainly in Petaluma. So it turns out that it's really a very popular program.
So do you think that this is something in your networks – nationally, are you hearing about gleaning taking off in many places all around? The Bay Area?
Yeah, definitely in the Bay Area. There's all sorts of, and so some of the permutations are food swaps. So we have a Wednesday morning food swap now in Petaluma that somebody else started, where people come bring their own, garden vegetables and they swap it out with each other. On the laundry list of things to do, is set up a block by block food exchange where everybody would first exchange food with whatever with their neighbors, and then the excess would go to, say, bounty hunters and so forth.
Grayson James of Petaluma Bounty. More information on all of the panelists featured as part of the CUESA event are linked to on the Deconstructing Dinner website at deconstructingdinner.ca. In this last segment from the Produce to the People panel, a question from a member of the audience who inquires into what types of policy challenges the panelists' organizations face. Grayson James offers an all-too-familiar tale of policies stifling local food systems. And a thanks to CUESA for making the audio heard here today available. You can learn more about the organization by visiting their website at CUESA.org. That's CUESA.org.
I'd like you guys to speak a little bit about the policy challenges that you face and things that can be maybe a easy or quick fix to policy or something that's a more idealist approach.
I have a good policy example. Our mobile market, the traveling pickup truck, was shut down by the city of Petaluma about 2 months ago. It makes six stops. It stops at Kaiser, Petaluma Health Center, elementary school, and several other places. And somebody at Kaiser complained that we were operating without a permit.
Kaiser?
I'm sure it wasn't Kaiser because they love us. Yeah. They really want us to be there. We don't know who it was. We never will probably. But it turns out when we had set the program up last summer, we talked to the city and we said, what do we need to go onto private property and sell, produce? And they said, well, if you're on private property, you don't need anything. We went in there and got the same answer twice. So we blithely went about our business, and then we were shut down. So we went back to they said, you're operating without a permit. So we said, well, what permit? They said, well, we don't know. We don't have one. That's why we don't have a policy for you. It actually wasn't quite, I had to actually tell them because it was somebody else, of course. And, So the city of Petaluma did a great job working with us. They get what we're doing. They appreciate it. And they said, well, first they came back wanting to charge us $1,100 per site for a use permit fee that we had to go through. And once we explained to them, you know, how we really needed to operate, they said, okay, we'll let you aggregate all that, and we'll waive all costs except out-of-pocket costs. And so that was settled. But then, meantime, the county of Sonoma stepped in, and we just got operational again this last week. And here's one of the things that we learned. We can grow food on the Bounty Farm and sell it on the Bounty Farm, but we can't sell it off the farm without jumping through certain hoops. We can buy food from other farms, including Veritable Vegetable, which we do, and sell it off the farm on our mobile market, but we can't sell that food on the farm. So what do you think we're going to do? We're going to have to drive our mobile market truck onto the farm and pull up to our farm stand where we're selling our Bounty Farm produced food and sell the non-Bounty Farm produced food off of our truck. Yeah. And so that's a good example. Here's another example. The city of Novato.
So you're saying that there needs to be a patch. There needs to be a fix in that policy.
Well, I would say more than a patch. Yeah, we got the patch.
Integrated policy.
Yeah, we need integrated policy. So there are these disconnects, lack of alignment.
Right.
One more example. There are folks been trying to set up a community garden in Novato for many, many years, and the city of Novato is treating them like a developer. They have to raise about $250,000 to do this garden because they have to do all sorts of rights of way and traffic mitigation and everything. So meanwhile, Petaluma is giving us a list of properties like they'd like us to set up gardens on so they don't have to pay maintenance and water. So, you know, each community is different, and the policies and the principles that and the understandings of the folks making those decisions are really different. So, again, we need
a state policy or a suggested policy for every community about how you could easily create urban gardens.
And we need to really get the word out about why this stuff is important.
Now
The Congos, and Food for the Rainy Day, here on Deconstructing Dinner. It's been a few months since we last heard from a regular contributor to the show, Bucky Bacaw and his Backyard Chicken broadcast. On this new episode, Bucky discusses the pros and cons of eating raw eggs, and he suggests from which source raw egg eaters might find the most confidence that salmonella is not a risk.
This is Bucky Bacaw with the Backyard Chicken Broadcast. One of the great things about living with chickens in your backyard and having fresh eggs around is being able to make some traditional egg recipes. Now, I know I already discussed the virtues of fresh eggs from the backyard over commercial eggs and even explained why you really shouldn't be eating commercial eggs in any case, whereas having chickens in your backyard is an exercise in self-sufficiency and sustainability and forging a good relationship with your food and the animals that produce it. It's what I talk about every week, for about 3 years, as a matter of fact. What I haven't mentioned specifically in a very long time is how much I love making a fried egg in a style we used to call sunny side up, with a nice runny yolk, or making boiled eggs soft boiled instead of cooked to death. I also love a real eggnog, with or without the rum, not to mention all the other nifty alcoholic drinks using raw egg, like the Pisco Sour, the Tom and Jerry, or the Ramos Gin Fizz. Now you may be saying, Bucky, I can, if I really want to, make all those things with commercial eggs. But the truth is, you're probably risking salmonella if you do that. I recently did a chickener profile with listener Alan from California, who said one of the main reasons he got started with backyard chickens was because he wanted to add raw eggs to his diet, but was concerned about the salmonella risk in corporate eggs. After the interview, my partner told me that when she was growing up, the kids used to make milkshakes out of milk, raw eggs, vanilla, and sugar. Cheaper and more delicious than with ice cream, and my guess is healthier too. She thinks maybe their dad, a Marine, passed the recipe on to the children's, but she doesn't really remember. Maybe they made it up themselves. At any rate, I tried it with our little Sarama eggs, a high-quality small farm milk, and some maple syrup. It sure tasted good. Now, there's a bit of debate on how much safer backyard chickens are from salmonella, but I'm going to argue, if you do everything right, keep an amount of chickens you can handle, and keep well-fed and housed in clean conditions, salmonella is going to be very unlikely. Maybe not impossible, but highly unlikely. Some say that a chicken doesn't have to appear sick to be carrying salmonella, but keep in mind how carefully you can monitor your bird's health and the conditions they're kept in if they're in your house. And then keep in mind that salmonella is on a spectrum. Generally, the really bad strains come from visibly sick chickens. A mildly infected chicken is not going to debilitate a healthy person. On the other hand, you're not going to find any mainstream source nowadays that tells you it's okay to go ahead and eat a raw commercial egg. There's very little debate that industrialization has increased the risk of salmonella from commercial eggs for several reasons. For one, factory birds routinely eat feed tainted with salmonella, such as dead and diseased chickens that the factories recycle into feed, as well as feed grains that are sometimes fertilized with contaminated manure. For another, factory farms have encouraged stronger strains of salmonella to emerge in the factories through excessive use of antibiotics. Then there's all the other unhealthy aspects of cramming unconscionable amount of animals together and treating them like production units, which causes a general immune deficiency and leaves the animals more vulnerable to salmonella and other illnesses. Now some of you may say, why even use raw eggs? It can't possibly be all you're cracking it up to be. But if you're saying that, it's probably because you've cracked open a store-bought egg and seen how gross it is. But you haven't seen what the backyard chickener and their friends know well. What inspired raw egg eaters, from days before factory farming, to invent nogs and holidays and runny over easy breakfasts. When done right, a runny yolk is simply a uniquely delicious and sensuous pleasure. But I may well be preaching to the choir here. I've noticed of late that there's a kind of groundswell of interest in the culinary delights of raw eggs. In February 2010, the New York Times ran a pretty long piece about all the bars in Manhattan serving drinks containing raw eggs. Apparently, it's against health codes to do that, but it's spottily enforced. Over and over again, bartenders said, "We source our eggs carefully. We treat our ingredients with care. We don't want our patrons to get sick. No one has. And enjoying these drinks is a good time." It makes me wonder what the real truth is about food safety laws. It is the industrialization of food that has made all these codes necessary, whereas it would seem as if industry wants you to think food is inherently dangerous, unless it's wrapped in plastic after going through a series of hidden tests. Yet clearly, that is not the case. The food safety rules do not seem to work, judging by how many contamination stories run in the news. I've noticed these same arguments coming from the raw milk enthusiasts. I'll tell you that I've tasted some of the semi-legal raw milk, and it is awfully delicious. Yet I am right with the mainstream, and that I'm still a little scared of raw milk. I like the way the raw milk clubbers talk, but I also know I don't have all the facts. On the other hand, I resent that industry doesn't want me to have those facts. Makes me want to eat raw stuff, just out of defiance. Just like with raw milk, a lot of sensible folks will tell you from their personal experience, raw eggs can be pretty good for you, health-wise. Especially raw yolk. It stands to reason that cooking eggs changes the structure of its proteins and alters the vitamin content. How much is, I suppose, a valid debate, but it's not a bad bet to at least some of your diet unaltered by heat. Significantly, some people who have egg allergies are not allergic to raw egg, and raw yolk has one of the highest concentrations of biotin found in nature. Biotin is one of the B vitamins, required in a number of enzymatic reactions in the body, like the production of energy from carbohydrates and fats. It's one of the vitamins suddenly getting a lot of press, even though it's not entirely clear who needs how much or why. Raw whites don't have as many health benefits, but they're another piece of the egg that's very useful in certain recipes. And except for the case of pregnant women, who should avoid raw egg whites, aren't going to hurt anyone, provided it's a salmonella and cruelty-free backyard egg. Now that so many people identify themselves as foodies or whatever, there's a lot of reevaluation of what's good to eat. Do an internet search on raw egg recipes or raw eggs. I suspect most of you will want to try some of the recipes you find, and maybe it'll inspire you to get chickens, or at least find someone with a small flock that you can see for yourself how clean it is, and get some appropriately fresh eggs. Since I'm having trouble finding credible information one way or another about raw eggs, I'd really appreciate if folks would send me their own experiences, positive or negative, with raw eggs. Send your questions and comments by email, or send me an MP3 file of your own voice to Bucky@RadioBoise.org. This is Bucky Bacaw signing off. I had a good time.
Bucky Bacaw's Backyard Chicken Broadcast was produced by the Sagebrush Variety Show with support from Boise Community Radio and the Green Institute.
A thanks to Bucky Bacaw for that segment. Past episodes of Bucky Bacaw featured here on Deconstructing Dinner are archived on our website as part of our Farming in the City series at deconstructingdinner.ca. You can also find links to unheard Bucky Bacaw segments by visiting the page for today's broadcast posted under the September 30th, 2010 episode. That was this week's edition of Deconstructing Dinner, produced and recorded at Nelson, British Columbia's Kootenai Co-op Radio. I've been your host, John Steinman. I thank my technical assistant, John Ryan. The theme music for Deconstructing Dinner is courtesy of Nelson area resident Adam Shake. This radio show is provided free of charge to campus community radio stations across the country and relies on the financial support from you, the listener. Support for the program can be donated through our website at deconstructingdinner.ca or by dialing 250-352-9600.